طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Welcome to the August 14th edition of This Week in Palestine on WZBC 90.3 FM, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fam and continued in his loving memory by his friends. I'm your host today, Despina Mutsouris, and on today's show we offer several perspectives on the upcoming bid for Palestinian statehood and recognition at the UN. We also look at the impact of this strategy on the wider struggle for peace, justice, and self-determination in Palestine. We'll begin our analysis today with a tape-recorded interview from Palestine Studies TV with legal scholar Victor Catan, who views the UN bid as full of positive opportunities for the Palestinian struggle. Victor is a policy advisor at Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Previously, he was a teaching fellow at the Center for International Studies and Diplomacy at the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London, from 2008 to 2011. Where he is studying towards a PhD on the evolution of the idea of partition in international law. To read a more in-depth analysis of Victor's view on the UN bid, you can go to www.al-shabaka.org. And there is a policy brief from May 2011 titled A State of Palestine, the Case for UN Recognition and Membership. But now we'll turn to the tape-recorded interview from Palestine Studies TV. Thank you.
Victor Catan is the author of From Coexistence to Conquest, International Law and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1891 to 1949. He is currently completing his doctoral degree from the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London. Thank you for watching Palestine Studies TV. I'm your host, Will Yeomans. Today we'll be chatting with Victor Catan, who is joining us from London. Thanks for your time, Victor.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you.
As you know, there's a lot of talk about the Palestinian option at the United Nations this September.
Well, President Abbas, in an op-ed that he published in the New York Times, I think a month ago, said that the strategy and the options that were available to the Palestinians was to seek recognition as a state and membership of the United Nations. President Abbas outlined that he wanted to seek full membership of the United Nations in the strategy, but there have been a few issues about that because of the possibility of a US veto. So another option which they might consider is upgrading their observer status to that of an observer state. At the moment they have like an observer status as a kind of entity, kind of like a special status which no other organization or state has.
Why is the Palestinian Authority considering going to the United Nations now?
I think there are several reasons. I think, these studies of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which said Palestine is ready for statehood by September, and I think it's been a strategy, at least in the minds of most officials, that they would seek this option in September of this year. I think a major issue was that made the Palestinian Authority decide to kind of go, I wouldn't call it unilateral, but to decide to go directly to the United Nations rather than pursue the negotiations with Israel. Partly that's because the negotiations haven't gone anywhere. They're deadlocked. I also think that back in February when the United States vetoed the settlements resolution, I think that upset a lot of Palestinians, and it made them finally realize that the United States is not such an honest broker. And another issue, I think, which had an impact on their decision was the publication of the Palestine Papers that was leaked in January by Al Jazeera and the Guardian newspaper, which really kind of, my reading of them was that it showed that the the policy of negotiations wasn't really going anywhere. I think it was clear after 10 years, after 15 years, but the papers covered 10 years, that no matter how many concessions the Palestinian negotiators were prepared to make, whether it was on Jerusalem or settlements, the Israelis seemed never to be satisfied. And I think when those documents were exposed, it embarrassed the Palestinian Authority. So I think that's also played a role. And another issue that I think must be on their minds, of course, is the current wave of uprisings going throughout the region, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and in Syria. And they must be thinking that they should do something, otherwise they could be next. So I think a combination of factors have led to this move.
In terms of United Nations membership, how does that relate to the quest for statehood, kind of as a legal concept?
Well, to be a full member state of the United, to be a full member of the United Nations, you have to be a state, because only states can be members of the United Nations. So that's the issue. So by implication, by applying for membership, the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, are essentially saying we are a state. The issue of recognition is more a matter, I think, of legitimacy. By asking more countries in the world to recognize that they are a state, it kind of gives it more moral force, I guess.
Would it trigger certain obligations on Israel's part that it currently doesn't have?
Yeah, if you're a state, you're entitled to sovereignty over your territory. You're entitled to your territorial integrity. What that means is that you're entitled to preserve your identity as a state, which means if another state invades you or breaches your territory, you're entitled to fight back, self-defense, if you've been attacked under the UN Charter, Article 51. So, yeah, it would give them that right, at least theoretically.
What do you think the PA should opt for?
They would be better off avoiding a confrontation with the United States by seeking full membership. That's my personal opinion. I think it would be better, at least to begin with, to seek the status of observer states. Because UN Charter recognizes that you can be a state, but not a full member. It recognizes non-member states and observer states. And then I would, if I was advising the Palestinians, after you've achieved that goal, you could ask states to recognize you as an observer state. And in addition, you could begin by trying to apply to join other international organizations, ratifying other treaties. And that might trigger opposition, or it might trigger some questions, by other states who oppose that view. Might question whether they are a state, and then there might be some opportunities for legal remedies. So they could ask the UN General Assembly to refer a question to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion. Along the lines of, is Palestine a state? Does it have the competence to join the United Nations or another international organization, for instance, or does it have the competence to ratify international treaties? So if they were to pursue that route rather than the Security Council, rather than seeking outright membership, I think that's a better strategy, because I think they have a stronger case and it avoids the political body of the Security Council, where they would face obstacles.
You yourself argued in 2009 that a Palestinian state that is recognized, quote, with its territory partitioned and subdivided into cantons, surrounded by walls, fences, ditches, watchtowers, and barbed wire, would scarcely be a state worthy of the name. You now seem to be saying that the Palestinians should still go for recognition for observer status to the UN as a sort of strategy towards statehood. What's changed?
Well, I'd say nothing on the ground has changed from, I think, my description 2 years ago is accurate today as it was when I made it. But I think at that time I overlooked some of the advantages of pursuing this strategy. And the main advantage that I can see is it would allow the Palestinians to ratify the statutes of the International Criminal Court, right, the Rome Statutes, which I think would be pretty significant. because if it was accepted, nothing would prevent the court from then looking at allegations that members of the Israeli armed forces and even political leaders have been accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity during Operation Cast Lead, and in other incidents could be investigated, which could have quite potential serious consequences and maybe beneficial consequences too. It might make Israelis think twice before using that kind of level of force in the future.
Israel at the moment is trying to prevent the Palestinians from being able to have this kind of forum in front of the United Nations. Do you think that they're being effective in their lobbying efforts?
But obviously, I don't know how effective they've been. I can only hazard a guess from what I read in the media. From what I've read, I think the Israelis have kind of ruled out most of the developing world, and they're mainly focusing on European countries. But to be honest, I might be wrong, but my hunch is I think that the Israelis have isolated themselves because of their policies, because of their hardline government. I don't think they're that popular. And at the end of the day, what the Palestinians are asking for is what, avowedly at least, the EU has been on the record saying that they support, that is, a two-state solution to the conflict, which explicitly a Palestinian state is the result of such a solution. So I can't see how it would not be in their interest or in their policy aims to support the Israelis in preventing the Palestinians from having a state.
What should the Palestinian Authority be doing now, prior to September, to advance their cause worldwide and counter the Israeli attempts to prevent?
Well, I think that they should be obviously lobbying these countries. I don't think they should take any vote for granted. And I've heard that. I think Abbas is now in Norway, or he's traveling for some European country, Italy, and a few other places. I understand several other top PA officials are going to India and other parts of the world, Australia. So I think that's the right strategy. But the Palestinian Authority might want to cast its net slightly wider. There's only so many of them, and they might want to use people who aren't in the government but support the Palestinian cause, like civil society, other people, like in Latin America, for instance. There are many Palestinians in the diaspora who could be put to good use. For instance, I think last time I checked, Honduras and El Salvador haven't recognized Palestine. Neither has Jamaica, for instance. And yet in all those countries, in fact, in El Salvador and Honduras, there were at one point in their history presidents who originally were of Palestinian origin. So, there are strong contacts there which could be made more use of. In fact, I don't know why when these chaps were presidents, the Palestinians, they didn't ask them for recognition at the time. I think that they've been a bit disorganized. And I understand that some of the recognition documents back from 1988, they've misplaced a few of them, and they're trying to find their records and catch up. So I think, it's also got to do with a bit shoddy organization, sounds all a bit last minute. Now, there's an advantage in that you catch the Israelis off foot, but the disadvantage, of course, is that they may have lost contacts and they may have misplaced previous statements of recognition.
Speaking of 1988, the declaration of the PLO of statehood in Algiers specifically, we had a question from someone on Twitter about how that declaration relates to the strive for UN membership.
Of course, in 1988, the PLO, which was then the only organization representing the Palestinian Authority, didn't exist then, was confined to Tunisia, and they issued that declaration from a summit in Algiers. And at that time, they didn't have any control over the West Bank or Gaza. So that's a major change, obviously, in the last 23 years or so. They do at least exercise effective control over substantial parts, not all, obviously, of the West Bank. So I think that's a major difference. I also think that if you look at the countries that recognized Palestine in 1988, they were mainly confined to the non-aligned movement, And since then, one would expect more countries to recognize Palestine, especially from the EU and other countries that haven't yet recognized them. So I think the advantage I'd say about the Declaration 1988 is that they already have over 100 recognitions from that date to build upon. They already have these relationships they should be building upon. In fact, they should have been building upon them for the last 20 years. But at least it's something to start with. They're not starting from scratch with no recognition. So I think they can be fairly sure they should get. You read in the Israeli media, for instance, at least 130 recognitions. I think if they could aim for slightly more, say 150, 154, 30 more recognitions than they presently have, they'd be on par with Israel, which would be, I think, quite significant, in the battle for legitimacy. Whether it has any consequences, time will tell.
Some have expressed fears that the strategy around statehood might preclude a binational state or a one-state solution sort of outcome. What's your response to that?
I mean, kind of two responses. One is, the Palestinians haven't got their state yet, and they might not do so. But even if they were to have a state, it doesn't preclude a state from merging in the future with another state. For instance, you had Egypt and Syria emerged in the 1950s, 60s as United Arab Republic. It didn't work, but it's possible. It's also possible if a Palestinian state does come into existence, they'd obviously have to draft a constitution, and they could state in the constitution that if at some future date a majority of people in Israel and Palestine decide to merge, that they could do that. For instance, if you look at the I think it's constitution of the Republic of Ireland, there is a clause in their constitution, and also I think in the Good Friday Agreement, that if a majority of citizens of Northern Ireland and the Republic concurrently vote to reunify the island, then that can take place. There'd be referendums obviously for that. So there are ways. I mean, it's not the end of the road. Having said that, of course, it might become more difficult if there are two states and you get very strong nationalism in both states. You could have an India-Pakistan situation. So it can go either ways. But if you want a safeguard, you could draft that into a constitution, for instance.
Well, you mentioned that this might alienate the United States, at least seeking a real membership. But wouldn't observer status also be opposed by the United States as kind of a unilateral Palestinian move that's outside of the context of negotiations with Israel?
Well, basically, the U.S. doesn't have a veto in the U.N. General Assembly, and all it would take is a simple majority vote to achieve the status of observer state. So even if the U.S. Blocked it, even if, for example, the U.S., the Europe, even if the whole of the EU, the U.S. and say another 20 states opposed it, they could still get it through, on the assumption that is that the so-called non-aligned states support them, which I imagine they would. The advantage of that is it avoids a U.S. confrontation, and then later on, you see, if they go the non-observer state route, later on when perhaps international politics is more precipitous, perhaps Obama is in a second term, feeling more confident. I don't know. The Palestinians could then seek full membership. It's not the end of the road. I mean, they may say that they want to seek full membership now, even if the U.S. vetoes, and then they could always apply again and again. Nothing prevents an entity from applying again. So that might be another strategy. But personally, I think that avoiding a confrontation is a smarter one. Trying to get it before an international legal forum where they'll get a better, fairer hearing is a better option to go for. And perhaps going for the full membership at a later stage might be a better strategy when they've had success, perhaps, in other forums.
So you think there's a high probability of success in front of the United Nations?
I think so, because the assumption is that most countries do support the Palestinian cause. Most members of the United Nations struggled against colonialism. They have a history of that. So they more readily identify with the Palestinian struggle. You know, the Arab League has, or the members of the Arab League amount to over 20 states. I imagine most African countries would support them. And we can assume that most Latin American states will support them because there's been a spate of recognitions from Latin America in the last 6 to 7 months. So they have a clear majority of states support the Palestinians out of the 193 member body. But the issue is in international politics is whether they get the support from the powerful, rich, developed countries, primarily North America, Europe, and Australasia. So the real issue, the real battleground, so to speak, will be Europe. So I think that's where the concentration of lobbying efforts will be. And I think that's where the Israelis are focusing. I think they've given up on the rest. They're focusing mainly on the EU countries.
Say the Palestinians were successful at gaining observer status. Does this automatically translate into a stronger bargaining position vis-a-vis Israel at the negotiation table?
Not in terms of, power as such, but what it allows is it will allow the Palestinians to seek support from other states, to maybe to seek a more multilateral approach to negotiations, and to get some of the core issues before an international court. So out of the unbalanced negotiation structure between Israel and Palestine, the Palestinians could say, look, we've pursued negotiations with you. We've been honest. We've been fair. We've laid everything on the table. We've been prepared to negotiate, but we've got nowhere with that. Perhaps we would have better luck before an international tribunal, which can look at the issues from a more, let's say, neutral standpoint, at least more neutral than the Israeli government. And that might, they could then bring that to the table. And by bringing this to the attention of the whole world, they might gain more support for their position and remind countries of their position. I think a lot of people have forgotten. That the Palestinian struggle is a long one, and that they do have a strong case, a legal case, in fact, morally and politically, but it's just never really discussed. So getting these issues in forums, I think would prove more successful, of course, depending what the issues are. If we look at the first and last time the Palestinians went before the International Court of Justice in the advisory opinion on the wall, they were practically, 14 judges ruled in favor of the Palestinian position, and even the U.S. judge who appended a separate opinion agreed with most of the issues. So the assumption is that, of course it depends what issues, but I think like a question that relates to the issue of is Palestine a state does it have the capacity to join international organizations and to ratify treaties? I think the answer is clear that it does, but getting the ICJ to perhaps say that would give them a stronger bargaining power, I think, than at the moment, where it's just them and the Israelis, and they're the clear underdog.
Well, I want to thank you very much for your time and your patience and for being on Palestine Studies TV.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you and welcome back to This Week in Palestine. I want to follow this interview by offering several contrasting perspectives from other activists and historians, journalists and scholars on the UN option. While Catan is positive and feels the biggest advantage is that UN membership or actually observer status for a state of Palestine will give them a legal platform to pursue justice through the ICJ and to curtail Israeli actions, others are not so sure. For example, Ali Abu Nima, in a post on August 8th on the Electronic Intifada, writes this: "The Western-backed Palestinian Authority's effort to seek UN recognition of statehood unilaterally, without consulting the Palestinian people, from which the PA has absolutely no mandate, has raised fears among Palestinians that the move could actually harm Palestinian rights. If the UN votes to admit the state of Palestine, it is likely that the unelected representatives of the Palestinian Authority would be seated in the General Assembly instead of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which currently holds the Palestine observer seat at the UN. This would serve a severe blow to the potential for realizing Palestinian rights in the long run through international bodies. Whereas the PLO ostensibly represents all Palestinians, the PA state would only represent its citizens, residents of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Of course, in reality, this state would not present anyone, since it would have absolutely no control of the territory on which it purports to exist, and its government, what is now the Palestinian Authority, would remain subject to the blackmail and pressure of its financiers and external political sponsors. Recognizing this danger, the BNC, which is the Boycott National Committee, states, the most fundamental and inalienable right of the Palestinian people is the right to self-determination. Ending the occupation is one pillar in exercising that right. The right to self-determination, which in the case of the Palestinians is represented by the PLO, is commonly defined as the right of all people, freely to determine, without external interference, their political status and to pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. It is a right held by all Palestinians, irrespective of their current location, by virtue of international law and the principles of popular sovereignty and democracy. All Palestinians, including the refugees in the Shatat, the diaspora, and Palestinian citizens of Israel, have a right to participate in and be represented in the UN and elsewhere. A democratic PLO that determines the political status and pursues the economic, social, and cultural development of the entire Palestinian people. In other words, a state of Palestine must not be allowed to replace or usurp the right to representation and self-determination of the whole Palestinian people. Of course, Palestinians frequently point out the PLO today is largely defunct, its offices usurped and held for life by the very people who run the PA. But legally, the PLO remains the only body and framework for representing all Palestinians, and protecting the possibility for the PLO to be revived in a truly representative form is absolutely vital. There's no doubt that the PA statehood bid at the UN, which enjoys no Palestinian consensus behind it, represents a direct threat to this possibility. In another article on killing popular resistance, Jamal Jumo, who is a coordinator of the Stop the Wall Coalition, had this to say when he was asked this particular question on the upcoming UN bid. He was specifically asked, the PA plans to go to the UN in September and ask for recognition of a Palestinian state. Do you agree with this approach? And Juma replied, we've been talking to national forces and leftist and democratic forces and institutions, as well as to the Palestinian human rights and civil society organizations. We developed a working paper that outlines our positions. We want to get a legal perspective on what international law says about going to the UN. We concluded that we should go, in fact, to the UN, but not in order to establish the state on the 1967 borders. We should be demanding that the membership of the PLO be raised to state status. The approach of going to the UN doesn't affect the right of return for Palestinian refugees or Palestinian rights or the PLO. We are going to follow these issues and hold town meetings in all districts. We are trying to come up with a position that we can submit for public discussion and to inform people what is happening, because no one tells the public what is going on. People don't know what the PA wants. In the same article, Juma also makes an interesting observation, which is counter to what Catan implied in his interview, is that, for example, the ICJ ruling that came out in 2004, the Palestinian Authority never pursued that through international forums. For example, he says, the official political aspect is worth noting. Pressure was placed on the Palestinian Authority and the PLO to leave the decision in a drawer, that's the ICJ decision, and not to move on it. So the decision was frozen and never submitted to the United Nations Security Council, even to this day. Today, more than any other time past, after the total closing of political horizons and the collapse of what is referred to as negotiations, and the clear U.S. position of total support for settlements, we say now we must start to challenge. We have to start a global battle in the international law arena. The first thing the PA must do is to take this recommendation and put it on track for implementation within the Security Council and other international fora. And the question is, why has it not done so up to this point? Yeah, one of the most interesting posts on the upcoming UN bid actually comes from longtime activist Mazen Kumsiya in a post on his blog dated August 4th and titled September. In that post, he says, "The proverbial straw that broke the camel's back leading to this essay was an email from Dr. Saeb Erekat today that included a document claiming to be strategies of the Palestinian leadership in going to the UN in September for recognition. I talk and work with activists on the ground daily. The message they all relay is that there is a widening rift between all political parties and the people. They know it and admit it. Many leaders said they can no longer mobilize people. The answer is known. Go back to the people and reignite the revolutionary spirit that exists within each of us. The therapies for the metastatic growth of settlements on Palestinian land to increase in racist laws, the increase in racist laws to the plight of the refugees all do not involve documents by Erekat or a resort to a biased international fora that issues resolutions that they were never willing to implement." And here he's referring to the UN. Under the category of what we have to do, Erekat's document states, "Open a strategic dialogue with the U.S. administration on the question of membership. It is evident that the use of the United States veto makes it impossible for Palestine to become a member state." Kumsiya responds to this by saying, "After 37 years of opening strategic dialogue with the U.S., 18 years of direct negotiations under the auspices of the U.S., under what logic can such a dialogue lead to anything? Just think of the standing ovations given to the war criminal Netanyahu in the U.S. Congress mm-hmm. to see that this is an illusion. If the PA could not even get Obama to stick to his own words on simple matters, for example, settlement activity must be stopped, what makes Erekat and company think that talking more will get Obama to help establish a Palestinian state? Our own representatives refuse to even boycott Israeli officials. Our UN representative attends a farewell party to the Israeli representative. Of course, everyone knows that we Palestinians are the ones being pressured and not the Israeli government. The trap of Oslo that created a class of people dependent on their livelihood on aid ensured that independent Palestinian decision-making is impossible. Under these circumstances, what makes anyone think that it is possible to change the status quo without removing the structures of dependency created by Oslo?" In a second point, Erekat states, "What we have to do. Recognizing a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders and becoming a UN member will make it easy for the Palestinian leadership to make a decision on the final status negotiations immediately on all issues without exception. Jerusalem, borders, settlements, refugees, water, security, and the release of prisoners and detainees." Kumsiya responds, "This is an extremely dangerous and misleading. Why is the UN recognition linked to unconditional return to fruitless negotiations? What makes anyone with any logic believe that the U.S. would change without us first changing and applying some real pressure? And since when is the Palestinian struggle reduced to a Palestinian state in part of the West Bank and Gaza? Many Palestinians point out that the records of previous negotiations show that Kuray, Erekat, and Abu Mazen were willing to give up on refugee and other rights in return for this emasculated state." In a third point, Erekat states, "In light of the President Obama's speech on May 19th, in which he talked about our choice to go to the UN for Palestinians, their efforts to delegitimize Israel will ultimately fail. The symbolic actions to isolate Israel from the UN in September will not create an independent state. It is clear that the Obama administration understands that we are going to the UN for an attempt to isolate and delegitimize Israel, that it is a symbolic act. Such effort will not lead to the creation of an independent state. This understanding is contrary to what we want to achieve from applying for membership for the state of Palestine on the 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. We do not seek to delegitimize Israel or isolate it, nor is this a symbolic act." Kumsiya responds to this by saying, "How many liberation movements in the world do you know that refuse to even try to isolate a repressive apartheid regime? Just like many other situations before, this Palestinian Authority wants to get Israel off the hook, just like when they shelved consideration of the Goldstone Report or when they lobbied Israel against release of Palestinian political prisoners. As for the event of the UN being a symbolic act, indeed that is what is being contemplated. The PA should instead get beyond symbolism and do serious actions like demand the UN rescind Israel's membership, since it failed to respect the UN Charter and violated its own promises to comply with its obligation. A real effort would entail asking UN member states to deal with Israel like they dealt with apartheid South Africa, since Israel fulfills all the requirements of an apartheid regime under the relevant international convention. Kumsiya ends his blog by saying, "My humble and open recommendation is for the Palestinian leadership to come back to the people and get new blood periodically. With this new blood, a mobilization of the Palestinians in exile can be done to effect real change by building appropriate short, medium, and long-term strategies, for example, by lobbying, media work, and BDS, boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. Mm-hmm. Internally, the Palestinian House needs to be put in order by implementing existing agreements to create a representative Palestinian National Council. That would create an atmosphere of real popular resistance that could indeed quickly change the dynamics on the ground." He ends by saying it is better to do this now than wait until September, when the people, having falsely raised their hopes for an end to occupation, will see the leaders who kept talking to them about September flounder and fall. Others who see a more positive spin on the UN bid, I mean, some benefits, still think that it is a short-sighted strategy and is unable to be very effective if it's not part of a broader reorientation in goals and strategies. For example, Noura Arakat, in an article published on the Jerusalem Fund website on July 25th, states, "While analysts sympathetic to Palestinian self-determination are debating the benefits of statehood and how to best achieve it, the better question to ask is whether such a bid is part of a broader reorientation in goals and strategies on the part of the current Palestinian leadership. The Palestinian Authority, no longer distinct from the PLO, which I refer to as the PA/PLO, is marked by a dismal track record in the past two decades, making such a reorientation highly unlikely, but not impossible." She goes on to say that statehood may afford the PA/PLO with more meaningful means to challenge Israel's occupation and apartheid, which is Catan's major point. However, the lack of such status would not be the sole obstacle containing the PA/PLO's resistance to injustice. In the meantime, a Palestinian and global society have made strident gains. The missing link is not statehood. It is a commitment to resist rather than appease Israeli occupation and U.S. prerogatives. Arakat ends her piece by saying, "For the statehood bid to be significant for Israel, for the United States, and for the Palestinian people, it must be made part of a larger reorientation and strategy and aims. At the center of such a shift, the PA/PLO must be ready to take its lead from the bottom," meaning from the grassroots level. An interesting example, contrast to the PLA strategy, was afforded in a blog post by Max Blumenthal on July 26th, responding to a discussion by local legal scholar Susan Akram at Boston University. Blumenthal writes, "She focused her lecture on contrasting the PA strategy with Namibia's, demonstrating how Namibia managed to achieve independence despite its initial designation by the UN to be one of the least likely colonial mandates to attain the status for statehood, and despite prolonged occupation by apartheid South Africa. Namibia and its supporters filed a steady stream of submissions to the International Court of Justice, winning decisions that combined the illegality of South Africa's occupation while demanding sanctions on South Africa. Thus, Namibia established a legal framework guaranteeing that any UN resolution granting it statehood would also establish its full independence," something that's missing from the current PA bid. In contrast, Akram notes, the PLA and PA accepted the formula of a negotiated land for peace, allowing the UN Security Council to relegate Resolution 194, the right of return resolution that guarantees individual inalienable Palestinian rights, to final status talks. Since Israel's occupation of Palestine began, the Palestinian Authority has made only one request for an advisory opinion from the ICJ, when in 2004 it challenged Israel's right to build the separation wall across the Green Line. Though the PA received a favorable ruling, it did nothing to enforce the ruling, no mobilization of civil society or demand for sanctions. In fact, despite the ICJ's recommendation, the PLA rejected the Palestinian civil society call to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel. Akram said the PA's failure to enact a strategy of soft and hard law has left an array of questions about the upcoming Palestinian statehood resolution unresolved, casting serious doubts on the whole endeavor. The consequences of statehood without real independence are enormous, Akram said. In the absence of a strategy based on hard and soft law, the PA's statehood resolution bid could be an exercise in futility. While Namibia relied on a protracted legal battle for 40 years with armed struggle and a political media strategy to lay the foundation for its independence, Akram warned that the outcome for Palestine is highly uncertain. And one of the more strong positions against the bid for statehood and recognition for Palestine comes from Sam Bahour in The Guardian on August 4th. In his first paragraph, he says, basically, the Palestinian National Liberation Movement has reached its end. As the Palestinian leadership, if there is such a legitimate body today, prepares to bring the issue of statehood to the UN this September, the weeks and months ahead will witness the last desperate attempt to get the international community to assume their responsibilities and ensure that a Palestinian state becomes a reality in the occupied territories. He goes on to say later that the after the struggle to revive the peace process for two decades, the Palestinians have lost faith in the process. For the entire period of the peace process, Israel plowed forward with more land confiscations, more settlement building, and more death and destruction. Any honest observer would reach a clear conclusion that Israel has no intention of allowing the Palestinians to create a new reality on the ground. This move, meaning the UN bid, gets an A for effort, but is doomed to fail, even if Palestine is admitted to the UN this year, next year, in 5 years, or not at all. The realities on the ground have changed drastically since 1947. Israel, with blind support, has succeeded in removing a two-state solution from the feasible options. Once this foredoomed move toward Palestinian membership in the UN runs its course, a new paradigm will take root. One that Israel dreads because it implicitly views Palestinians and Israelis as equals, as co-citizens, and as partners. This new shift will see Palestinians dropping their desire for independent statehood in a fraction of their homeland. The Palestinians are about to come full circle. They were correct, painfully so, to call for a secular democratic state at the outset of this conflict. Sadly, they wasted precious time and lost too many lives trying to accept unjust modalities of a resolution. Now, the sooner the Palestinian and Israelis realize that our destiny is to live together as equals, the sooner we can begin to rehabilitate our communities and build a single society whose citizens are all equal under the law and equal as human beings. So you can see, regardless of whether one is for or against this strategy, sees more risks or benefits, there are three important needs that I see that are currently unmet by the de facto Palestinian leadership. One unmet need is the need for deep analysis of the Palestinian question and a more broad vision encompassing all sectors of Palestinian society from the ground up. A second unmet need is the need to transform and reconstitute the PLO, or if that's not possible, to create a new, more representative body. And lastly, and more importantly, the need for leadership to turn to and trust its own people. We've seen Abbas go to the UN, we've seen him go to other countries, but has the current leadership ever faced their people to admit, yes, Oslo is dead, the two-state solution is dead, you know, what do we do and how can you help us? I believe that once the Palestinian leadership turns in faith to its own people, it will realize that there lies the source of inspiration, of motivation, of ideas, of vision, and of strength. And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, a 45-minute segment that is part of Truth and Justice Radio, airing on WZBC 90.3 FM from 6 to 10 a.m. Please note that starting on Sunday, September 5th, This Week in Palestine will be moving to a new broadcast time. Currently, the definitive time has not been set. We are planning either 9 a.m. or 9:15, but mark your calendars on the change, and we hope you join us again next week for news and views from and about Palestine.